can be no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way in which it treats its children.
This is the first podcast of CPLO, the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office based in Cape Town, South Africa. Since 1997, the CPLO has provided an open forum for concentrated debates on a broad range of public policy issues. These debates have exerted an influence for the common good in areas of political, economic, and social concern. We make submissions on legislation, we publish briefing papers, and we host regular roundtable discussions where we try to bring together members of civil society, the broader faith community, government officials, and political decision makers. News of our events and our podcasts can be accessed via our website at cplo.org.za. Please sign up for our newsletter. In light of the groundbreaking 2019 Constitutional Court of South Africa ruling that the common law defense of reasonable and moderate parental chastisement was indefensible, we decided to convene a panel on violence against children, which took place on 28th November 2019. The speakers were Shanaz Matthews, who directs the Children's Institute at the University of Cape Town, Carol Bauer, a child rights consultant, Divya Naidu from Save the Children South Africa, and Isabel Magaya, who works at the Center for Child Law. The event was moderated by Gugu Gqaba, Program Director at Save the Children. Biographies of the speakers appear on our website. Thanks for listening. Please remember to subscribe at cplo.org.za. The event was introduced by Steve Miller, CEO of Save the Children South Africa.
My name is Gugu Gqaba. I'm currently the program director in Save the Children South Africa. We have today the Catholic Parliament Liaison Office that is bringing us together to have a conversation about violence against children, because this is a conversation that South Africa needs. Steve Miller.
My name is Steve. I'm the new CEO at Save the Children South Africa. So thank you for coming. 2019 is an auspicious year. Of course, we celebrate 30 years of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, and there's a lot of events around this throughout the country that I'm sure you've been part of, and so it's pertinent that we're holding this today too. It's also the 100th anniversary of Save the Children, and I'm not going to talk much about our organization because that's not the topic today, but just to take us back 100 years ago to what actually happened when this organization was formed in the aftermath of World War I, and how our founders reached across the lines of a terrible, ferocious war to help children. And this was very controversial at the time. But when they put together this fund, they garnered the support they needed to do their work. That momentum, those people in society who put aside all their differences to focus on children, are always there. And this organization grew, the Universal Declaration on the Rights of the Child, and eventually, in 1989, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. And here we are today. And so for us, when we look at South Africa and the violence that we see in our society today, we are concerned, we are disturbed, we're outraged by what we see, as I'm sure all of you are, and something needs to be done. We connect this issue of corporal punishment very solidly to the violence that we see in our society today. And the reason we've brought everybody together is so we can hear from the experts, the people who understand this subject from different perspectives, be it from the legal perspective, from the perspective of a social worker, people who can bring us the full story so that we as individuals, no matter what we're doing, whether we're working in Parliament, whether we're working on the streets, whether we're working as activists, we have more knowledge to take this issue forward. So that's what today is about, and I'll allow Gugu to introduce our guests. I think just from a quick sort of housekeeping side of things, there is a podcast that's been recorded today, so Gugu is going to be very strong on the timing. She's going to keep us moving. But we do have that section towards the end for everybody to engage. So please, for me, that is obviously the most important part of today. Let's get as much of your energy out there as possible. Engage with our panel, and let's have a good discussion around this. And let this just be a starting point. We want to hold more of these discussions going forward next year as well, and of course on individual basis with all of you. So let this just be a starting point for this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve, for that great welcome and introduction. And at this point, I'd like to introduce Professor Shanaz Matthews, the Director of Children's Institute in UCT. Over to you, Prof.
So what I'm going to talk about today is really thinking about what are the intergenerational implications of violence against children, but also wanting within that to start thinking about what's the link between violence against women and violence against children? Because often we keep these two quite siloed and we don't connect the two problems, and it's so interrelated in my understanding. So, firstly, I want to introduce to you what I understand as a life course understanding of violence, and I think it's really critical for us to start thinking about violence that doesn't occur once off, and that it often co-occurs in multiple settings, and it often occurs early, and you see the kind of trajectory. So if you're thinking about violence, my work shows that infanticide is a huge problem in South Africa. That's the killing of a baby soon after they're born. And we don't have time to get into that, but I think it's really important that we start conceptualizing violence really differently. We all know about child maltreatment. That's an area most of us work in, and that's what we see as the most common problem affecting children. And I think it's really important that we understand child maltreatment as intersecting forms of violence, that it's not just physical, it's not just sexual, and it's not just psychological, but they actually intersect and overlap. And I think that's really critical for us to start understanding that we can't separate them out neatly. Sexual violence occurs across the lifespan, from birth into adulthood and beyond. I want to include intimate partner violence because I think it's really critical that we start understanding that violence against children also includes dating violence. And for young women, it occurs very early on, and often from the age of about when they start dating, 13, 14, even younger than that. And I think that's really critical for us to start thinking about the conceptualization that you can't tease out these forms of violence very neatly. Youth violence. Often we don't talk about it, but it is violence against children. And it's a huge problem in South Africa. And it's also a driver of multiple other forms of violence. And if we don't acknowledge it and bring it into our spaces, we're not going to, if our aim is to end violence, to actually get to that. I was not going to talk about the size of the problem in South Africa, and then Divya said to me, actually do speak about it. So I think it's really important, and as we're sitting in the room, we certainly acknowledge that violence is a big problem, but do we know how big the problem is? So the first national estimates that we have on violence against children is from the Optimus study that tells us that about 1 in 3 children in South Africa have experienced sexual violence or physical abuse. It translates to about 350,000 new cases per year. That's enormous. If we think about it, we've got just under 20,000 social workers working in South Africa, and not all of them are working on child abuse. Do we have the capacity to effectively deal with this number of cases? But what's interesting is that community-based focus studies are giving us higher estimates. So if we're looking at work done in the Eastern Cape, your physical abuse rates are higher. Similarly, emotional abuse and neglect, higher than what's reported in the national estimates. And I think it's really critical that we start thinking about these problems as not, you know, as much higher than what we're conceptualizing, because there is such a huge problem of underreporting. In fact, some studies for sexual violence are saying only 1 in 9 cases gets reported. So what we're dealing with is far bigger than what we're currently assuming. So if we're looking at, I've got a very outdated stats from SAPS here. Divya, I've got the wrong slide, but anyway. But what we do know is that just under half of all reported cases to SAPS are those of children. And for the last reporting year, it was about 25,000 children. 25,000 children that reported a sexual offence. So that has huge implications if I'm saying only 1 in 9 cases gets reported. A study that I've been part of the Birth to 20 cohort study, which is a birth cohort where children was born in Soweto in 1990, and they're called Mandela's children. And they were recruited into a birth cohort study, which means you follow up those children over their lifespan. And we followed them up for nearly 30 years. And what we have done is we've kind of looked at all the data points and looked at the experience of violence of children, the children have had over their life course. What that piece of work had shown us, and we kind of clumped it, so never experience, one experience, and so we've clumped these experiences together. The important thing that what this Birth to 20 study, and we've got about nearly 4,000 children that we've been following up over this period of time, but what this analysis is showing us is that 99% of children in that cohort have either experienced or have witnessed violence, been exposed to violence. Now, you're going to say, but this is Soweto and this is 1990, but I would say that this is very similar in most other communities like Soweto in South Africa, where exposure and experience is incredibly high. And the reason I'm talking about exposure as well, because we often speak about experience, but exposure of violence has very similar effects to a child. And it's really, really critical that we start understanding what the impact of exposure is. So if we start looking at the kind of, we see a bell-shaped curve when we start thinking about the highest experiences of violence occur in the kind of adolescent years. But it doesn't mean that children early on don't experience violence and later on don't experience violence either. The area that I have delved into probably for the past 10 years is the children that have died as a result of violence, so looking at child murders in South Africa. And what this work has shown us is that, in fact, we have more than 1,000 children murdered in South Africa. What my work has delved into is what proportion of children who are murdered in the context of fatal child abuse. And you're going to say, but aren't all of these child abuse cases? And I'm wanting to show you this graph. Not going to go into much detail, but just to tell you, firstly, South Africa has a child homicide rate or murder rate of 5.5 per 100,000. Why that is important is because if you look at population rates, that's the way you can compare across countries. Globally, the child homicide rate is 2.4 per 100,000. So if you compare our rate to the global rate, we more than double the global rate. Not doing well. So if you're looking at child murders and the pattern of child murders, you see your under 5-year-olds are most likely to be killed in the home in the context of fatal child abuse. What this is telling us is that children who are murdered just don't have the ability to protect themselves. They're young children in the context of the home, and it's often no one knows what's happening to that child because they're in the home. They don't have contact with others, or where people know something's not okay, they're not talking about it, they're not reporting it. So how do we end the silence about what's happening in the home? You'll see, it's U-shaped. So from the age of about 12, 13, you start seeing an increase. And what you're looking at there is an increase of male-on-male interpersonal violence. And you're starting to see youth, and particularly young men, take on behaviors of older men. And that drives our problem of male homicide in South Africa. So when you start thinking about why is our society so violent, you've got to look at this pattern in terms of when children start experiencing violence and seeing that actually it starts very early. So it's really important that we understand that violence doesn't only result in the physical scars that you see. So it's not just the kind of broken bones or the scars, but it actually has long-term, long-lasting effects. I think it's really critical that we start unpacking what does it do when a really young child, and I'm going to talk about this, I've got 10 minutes left, when a very young child experiences violence, it impacts on their cognitive and psychosocial development that affects lifelong how they're going to interact, not just within the family, but with their own peers, and then later on, and I'll talk a little bit, how that impacts on their own interpersonal relationships later on in life. We know it influences poor school outcomes, delinquent behavior, risky sexual behavior, increased risk for substance abuse, mental health problems, as well as increased aggression. Now, I'm not going to go into this in detail, but I think it's really important for us to start thinking about what science is showing us is that epigenetics is really, really critical for shaping children's trajectory. I think it's really important for us to understand that it's not just genetic makeup that you're born, but that genetic makeup is influenced by your own environmental factors as well. And I'm going to talk about what that means. So although the experiences in those early years, particularly in the first 1,000 days, can rearrange your epigenetic markers that the child and gene expressions within that child. It's very complicated, but I think we need to, as a sector, understand this more clearly, because I think it's critical for us to understand that those early years shape who that child becomes. And we actually, if there are family violence and if children are experiencing violence in those early years, it sets them up for failure long term. And that's the important part of talking about this. So when you talk about violence in those early years, children, what scientists are calling toxic stress now, and it's really about that prolonged exposure to adversity. So it doesn't just have to be physical violence, but it's the neglect, it's the maltreatment the children experience early on that then result in biological responses. It affects the architecture of that child's brain, and that's why I said, you know, it sets them up for failure long term. And if we can hold that child and give them a nurturing, caring environment early on, you're actually setting them up in a way that allows them to be caring themselves later on. So we do see it impairs school readiness, academic achievement, both physical and mental health. So it's not just mental health. So work in the US that have followed and look what they called ACEs. So the ACEs studies in the US have shown the relationship between violence exposure during childhood and later physical health. So it's not just mental health that we always assume is just mental health, but it's also physical health. Poverty, violent neighborhoods all affect outcomes for children as well. So it is really critical that we start thinking about how we support children. If we're looking at levels of poverty in South Africa, how do we support children across their life course and not just, and I think although we've got early, ECD is on government's agenda, it shouldn't be stopping within those first few years. It should be, how do we scaffold across the life course of the child? So I think it's really critical that in my work, and this is probably about 10, 12 years ago, I did work with men, very violent men in prison who killed their intimate partners. So my interest is both violence against women and violence against children. And it became increasingly clear that the experiences of these very, very violent men who've all been in prison for killing their partners, early experiences certainly had shaped who they became. And that's really critical. So what we do know is that victims who become, so children who are victims of violence often get trapped in cycles of violence, and there's repeated victimization. And what we do see also, outcomes differ for based on gender. So girls are at increase who are exposed to violence early on are at increased risk for internalizing, which means that they set up more to have mental health problems. So like increased risk for depression, increased risk for anxiety. Boys, on the other hand, you see externalizing behavior. So it's your kind of violent behavior that shapes masculinity in South Africa. And what we do know, it also in both genders reduce the ability for emotional attachment later on. And that's really critical in the work we do. I'm going to go through this quite quickly because I've got 5 minutes left and I'm not going to go through all these kind of, but what I want to say is that the intergenerational cycling of violence is really, really critical, and I will make the slides available so you can have the slides. But I think the most important, what I want to stress here is that there is what my work is showing is a clear intergenerational cycling of violence, often when mothers, particularly mothers, where they single mothers, have been exposed to violence, children are at increased risk themselves. And that is becoming clearer. And our services are not taking that into account when they're seeing children. I've spoken about the differential impact of violence on girls and boys, and I think the important thing here is in my work with men, men talk about feeling when they're exposed to domestic violence in the home that they're just not able to protect their mothers. And I think that's really critical that, you know, children, and particularly male children, feel that they have that role as protector and not able to do that. So when we're pulling together kind of childhood adversities, thinking about these men who've come to kill an intimate partner, they all talk about rough and hard childhoods with really limited positive attention from their own mothers. And that's really important, that we've got to understand that violence isn't just at the hands of males. So often women themselves are quite violent towards their own children, and we need to start understanding that. Absent fathers came out really, really clearly that often the fathers, when they were around, were emotionally not involved, and when they weren't around, often these young men would fantasize who their fathers were. And it is about searching for identity. And without having that in the home, it becomes so easy to get involved in gang activities in communities. So seeking that affirmation outside the family often leads to criminal activities, and therefore pathways to take on violent masculinities, although it's very complex, it has complex emotional and social factors that we've got to take into account, it's really important in terms of stemming the tide of violent behavior. Now, I think what I just want to highlight here is that this is looking at structural pathways from child abuse to male perpetration. Work has been done in South Africa, and what comes out here is that mental health exposure, so mental health problems are incredibly high in this group of men who become perpetrators, binge drinking as well as PTSD. And therefore, it's really important to prevent these kind of, long-term mental health problems if we're wanting to curb some of the violence we are seeing. This is complicated, but just wanting to say that with women as well who have experienced child abuse, there's an increased risk for them to experience intimate partner violence. And what this is just showing you is some of the pathways. And we don't have time. I've got 1 minute left. So I'm wanting to talk about the intersecting forms of violence, and I'm probably going to stop here. But it's really important for us to understand that violence against women and violence against children co-occur in the same household. They share the same risk factors, and they're driven by the same social norms. And therefore, it becomes imperative that we start thinking about how we address these problems simultaneously. I think it's really critical that when you're working with a child, you don't forget that the child's part of a family and that there is a system that you're working with. And similarly, when you're addressing violence against women, you should be considering what's happening to the child. And I think once we're starting to think about how we introduce interventions that address both simultaneously, we might be moving forward. But clearly we know that this is a complex area that's not easy to resolve, but it is, I think, critical that we start thinking about how we work collaboratively instead of in silos. And I think that's where I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Shanaz. And with that, I'd like to introduce you to a child rights consultant, Carol Bauer.
All right. So I was asked to talk about corporal punishment specifically. And in the light of the decision by the Constitutional Court on the 18th of September that you can no longer, as a parent, use the defense of reasonable chastisement when accused of assaulting your child. And the fallout from that has been very interesting, and I want to talk a little bit about some of that. But one of the things that people say who disagree with this finding is that the state has no right to interfere in the private sphere, and we are turning into a nanny state. And so that's why I've called my presentation Nanny State or Constitutional Responsibility. What I'm going to talk about is what the Concord actually did say, because there's some confusion about that. It is not the case that they prohibited corporal punishment. They did something else which effectively prohibits corporal punishment, and I'll talk a little bit about that. What does this mean for parents? There's a lot of fear that parents are going to be criminalized for every little smack and that the children of the country are going to be beating a path to the door of the nearest police station to lay charges against their parents for merest slaps. Look a little bit about corporal punishment specifically in South Africa, common issues that are raised when the issue of prohibition is brought up, the difference between punishment and discipline, because there is a very huge difference between them, and when I tell people I don't think they should hit their children, they say, well, how else do we discipline them? Well, the fact is that discipline and punishment are two different things. Oh, sorry, not yet. Then there are a series, as Shanaz pointed out, of negative outcomes of childhood experience of violence, including corporal punishment, even the so-called loving little smacks. One of those most serious financial consequences is the financial. One of the most serious consequences of violence in childhood is the economic and fiscal outcomes that fall from that, what the constitutional obligations of the state are, and what happens next. So what the Concord actually said was that there was something in our common law, which we inherited from Roman Dutch law, from the colonizers, that said if you hit your child, our law prohibits you hitting anybody, but this defense allowed you to say, well, I hit this person because they are my child and I'm disciplining them. And the whole issue arose out of a case in Johannesburg or somewhere in Gauteng, I think it was Johannesburg, where a father punished his 13-year-old son for looking at pornography on his iPad. Now, whether or not the child was looking at pornography, that is actually questionable. It seemed he wasn't. What the father did was not acceptable. The mother laid charges. The father was found guilty and sentenced to 5 years, suspended for 5 years, and his firearms license was revoked, and I think that's what really got him, because he appealed that decision, that court finding, on the grounds of this defense. Long story short, it ended up going through a legal process to end up in the Concord to find that, in fact, the defense of reasonable chastisement is unconstitutional, and specifically in terms of sections 10 and 12(1)(c) and 28(2) of the Constitution, which deal with the right to dignity, to not living in fear of violence, and also, although it didn't come out particularly in the ruling, you must remember that our Constitution forbids discrimination on any grounds, including age. And just because you're little doesn't mean you're excluded, any age. What was very important, there's some things about the judgment that those of us who were involved are not delirious about, but we got what we wanted, and I've worked for this for nearly 20 years, so I just wanted to celebrate. But what was very important about it was that they specifically defined corporal punishment as a form of violence against children. Because there's this notion that there's a difference between smacks and abuse. And that is not actually the case. Because if I didn't like what the lady over there looking at her phone was wearing, and that she was looking at her phone and I walked over and clapped her, she could go straight to the nearest police station and report me. I don't have to hurt her. I don't have to break bones. I don't have to draw blood. I just have to strike her. It's not allowed. Unless she happens to be my child and I'm cross. So that was very important, that now corporal punishment is defined as a form of violence, and by default, corporal punishment in the home became outlawed, because no parent can now go to court and say, yes, I did hit my child, but I was allowed to for this reason. So what does this mean for parents? Well, the fact is we do not want to criminalize parents. It is very, very seldom in children's best interests that their parents are put in jail. So that would be the last thing we want. It is not an infringement of parental rights. You can do whatever the hell you like in your own home, except hurt somebody else. And if that somebody else is your child, that doesn't mean it's okay. And it's not an infringement of your rights to religious freedom. There is, in fact, nowhere in the Bible that the words spare the rod and spoil the child appear. I'll talk more about that just now. There are lots of things about rods and chastisement, but not that particular phrase. And what it gives to parents is support for positive discipline and nurturing parenting. It opens the space for people to start thinking about how they parent and what the consequences of that kind of parenting are. Chinaz has mentioned a lot of the stuff I'm going to talk to you about as well, because it's the only real research we have, the Optimus study. There's been other stuff before, but nothing as thorough and complete. 42% of children had experienced some form of violence perpetrated by a caregiver. Corporal punishment as discipline gone wrong contributes significantly to child homicide, according to the 2015 child homicide study, which Chinaz actually was involved in running. And corporal punishment of children in the home is widely accepted. It's widely tolerated. So, God says we mustn't. Well, actually, there is no biblical mandate to beat children anywhere in the Bible. There is lots of stuff about rods and chastisement, and that references to a fact sheet that was developed by Sonke Gender Justice, which looked at some of these myths about corporal punishment and gave the facts. The words spare the rod and spoil the child were first used in a poem in the 16th century about a sexual relationship between an older woman and a boy. Fact sheet will give you the full quote. I like telling people who tell me that God says we mustn't hit our children that the first time that that phrase was actually used was in a probably pornographic 16th century poem. Cultural grounds, it's not in my culture. Well, 7 countries in Africa prohibited corporal punishment before we did. We were the 8th. We are the 57th country in the world. But aside from that, it's not true that corporal punishment is culturally endemic to Africa. It seems to be culturally endemic to anywhere where colonizers went, actually. And it was brought to Africa certainly by slave traders, by missionaries, and by the colonizers. And there are many sayings in many African languages. One that always comes to mind easily is a Zulu saying, which I wish I could say in Zulu, but I can't, but basically says, you do not raise a happy house with a stick. Or you do not build a happy house with a stick. And there's lots of those that kind of folk wisdom in terms of child rearing. There's also another fact sheet on that stuff. And as I said, 7 countries have banned before we did, and we are the 8th African country to do that. It happened to me, and it did me no harm. Well, firstly, how do you know it didn't do you any harm? How do you know how you would have turned out had it not happened to you? But secondly, I ask you to look around and then tell me that you think we're turning out all right. When you look at our high levels of violence, when you look at the rate at which we rape, murder, and kill, there are serious grounds for knowing that we are not turning out all right. So the stats, living in society is violent as ours, 58 murders a day, 3 children murdered every day. Our child homicide, I've said twice the global average, but Chinaz's figures prove me wrong. It's more than double the global average. 6 women are killed by their intimate partners a day, nearly 140 reported rapes a day. This is an extraordinarily violent place to live. And we must understand that we teach children the wrong lessons when we hit them. We teach them that it's okay for bigger, stronger people to hurt smaller, weaker people with impunity. And that you have no say, no rights, no opinion, no nothing. So, when we say don't hit children, do we mean don't discipline them? No, of course we don't. We need to understand what the difference is. Punishment, both words come from Latin. Punishment means quite literally to chasten, to retaliate, to whip, to scourge, to hurt, to punish. Discipline means to teach, to instruct, to train. It's about imparting knowledge. That's why we have disciples, for example, or rather why Jesus had disciples. There is a host of negative consequences to corporal punishment. A 2012 paper that looked at 2 decades of research that was done by Elizabeth Gershoff and her colleagues at the University of Texas found that no study showed that hitting children had good developmental outcomes. The best that some studies showed was that it didn't make much difference, but most studies showed that it makes an incredible difference. Most child physical abuse actually occurs in the context of punishment. And a professional consensus is emerging that we have to find ways of supporting nonviolent parenting. So the adverse consequences, and my slides are also available if anybody wants them. There's increases in aggression, delinquency, antisocial behavior in both childhood and adulthood. Shanaz's point about the life course, of violence is incredibly important. It's not something that happens in phases. It's everywhere. There's an increased risk of abusing their own child or spouse or of being the victim of abuse in adulthood. It has adverse cognitive outcomes. We know that, as Shanar said, the structure of the brain has actually changed in utero when the child is exposed to violence, or when the mother of the pregnant woman is exposed to violence, and that continues in those first 1,000 days, which start at birth, at conception, and end at 24 months. It definitely has an effect also on intelligence. In a study that was done in West Africa a couple of years ago, there were two samples of schools, one where corporal punishment was allowed and one where it was not. On average, the IQs of the children in the school where there was no corporal punishment were 5 IQ points higher than the other schools. So there is so much evidence that these things, physical outcomes, of course there's broken bones and bruising, but there's also death way too often. And it's because parents don't have support to parent differently, and that's what they know, and that's what how they were brought up, and it goes around and around and around. I'll never forget when the grandmother of the Dross rapist in Pretoria appeared sobbing on TV to tell us all how her son wasn't really a rapist and he made a mistake. That's not the subject of this, but what came out of that was that he had the most hideous childhood. And my first thought was maybe we should be holding parents liable, accountable for the horrible behavior of their adult children. I bet you dollars to donuts her childhood was just as bad. And that's the point. It goes round and round and round in circles. 45% of all child homicide is child abuse and neglect related. And that's a Medical Research Council finding. The neurological outcomes we've talked about. Social outcomes, there's difficulty in relating, there's depression problems, there's lots of things that happen that can happen from the very early on in the child's life and then get worse and worse and worse as they get older. Aggression is reliably linked to violence experienced in childhood. And then the thing that Shanaz was talking about, the genetic links between how children experience and process and what happens as a result of experiencing violence. But one important thing that we often forget about is that this costs a lot of money. And when we try to say, as civil society organizations working around these issues, to government, we need to put far more money into prevention and early intervention, they say, oh, well, that's very expensive. The fact of the matter is it's a hell of a lot cheaper, quite a significant lot cheaper than not doing it. And a couple of studies that were done fairly recently, both came out in 2017. KPMG, sorry, conservatively estimated that gender-based violence costs South Africa between 284 and 424 billion rand a year, or between 0.9 and 1.3% of the GDP. And GBV is specifically defined in that study to include violence against children. The Save the Children study also came out in 2017. 238 billion was what it cost in South Africa in 2015. That because we did not prevent that abuse happening in the first instance. And the costs were about things like the over the lifetime, the disability, both emotional and in other ways, that children who've experienced violence as they grow up, that kind of wants them for their whole lives. It cuts down their productivity, it cuts down their ability to sustain themselves and support a family. There's reduced earnings, there's clear evidence that children who come from homes where there was violence and where they were beaten are much more, they have so many things that make their lives difficult afterwards, they need much more support. That all costs. And what is not included in any of those costs, and this is very important, was none of the criminal justice system processes. So none of the investigation, none of the trial, none of that. Just from the social services side was what it was looked at. The Constitution says everyone has the right, has inherent dignity. These are the sections that the decision was used. Everyone has a right to freedom and security of person, and a child's best interests are of paramount importance in all things. And then there's also the Children's Act, in particular sections 144 and 145, which talk about support to parenting and make grand claims or say every provincial MEC for social development is supposed to annually do an audit of services available to children in their province, and they have to put in place according to the law, where there are no services, they need to find somebody to do those things. Nobody's doing that, of course, but that's what the law says. Children are holders of rights in their own right. One of the most difficult aspects of these conversations is that people really do still think they own their children. And the fact is they don't. Nobody owns anybody else. That's called slavery. Children have just as much rights as everybody else, and in fact they have a few more, because they are vulnerable, they are small, they are developing, they are growing, they need greater protection. So it's not true that they hold these rights in their own right. They're not simply your appendage. And it's not true that government has no right to interfere in the private sphere. Government is obliged by the Constitution to interfere in the private sphere. That's why we have domestic violence legislation. As I said earlier, you can do whatever the hell you like in your own home, but you cannot hurt anyone else. And as good evidence of that is the decision that was taken about the unconstitutionality of not allowing people to smoke dacha or grow dacha for their own personal use in their own homes. That's not hurting anybody. That you can do that, but you can't hurt anybody. That is not allowed. What's next? There's a national campaign being planned to try and change attitudes and behavior. There's a treasury, but several people in this room are part of that. We want active support to nonviolent and nurturing parenting, which emphasizes discipline rather than punishment. Scale up and roll out interventions which have evidence to back them, and there are a number of those, and it's not a new idea. And we feel that, well, I feel that issues around parenting and non-violent, being non-violent, should be included in the life orientation curriculum in schools. So that's what's next. Thank you.
At this point, I'd like to introduce to you from the Center of Child Law in the University of Pretoria, Isabel Magaya.
Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So we've heard about the violence that is actually, corporal punishment, first of all, is conceptualized as violence against children. We've heard and seen the evidence, and also Carol has spoken to us about what the Constitutional Court judgment essentially means, what it actually means. So now I'm going to talk about what we need to do, what each of us in this room can do to contribute to the changes that we want to see. So one of the ways that I'm going to do that is I'm going to focus on the development of the law in South Africa. I'm going to talk about the common law by the court. So Carol has already touched on that, so I'm not going to go into greater detail. And I'm also going to talk about the benefits of having a provision on corporal punishment in the Children's Third Amendment Bill. So in law, well, those of you that are very familiar with the law know that once the courts have developed the common law, it is essentially law. It's there. So why are we trying to padlock, or why are we stating the obvious? So I'm going to talk about the benefits and the needs of why we need to have a specific provision in the Children's Act. Oh, yes, and the question of the what. So we do agree that we need to have something in the Children's Act, but what is that thing that we need to have in the Act? So as Carol touched upon, so firstly, there are two ways that we develop the law in South Africa. So we can either do it through the courts, or we can do it through the legislature. So that's a whole parliamentary process where both houses of parliament look at legislation, and then they agree on what they want the legislation to say. So for corporal punishment, courts have already developed the common law. They've already changed the law. And that aligns with Section 2 of the Supremacy Clause. So that's basically going to what Carol spoke about, you know, the supremacy of the Constitution, that the Constitution is the supreme law in the land. And if the common law does not meet tenets of the Constitution, then it must fall. So two ways that it must fall is, if it's inconsistent with the Constitution, the court can and must, and so very often do, strike down the law. And where the common law does not adequately give effect to a right in the Bill of Rights, the courts are obliged, so they're constitutionally mandated to develop the common law, which is what they did. And the impact of the Constitution on the common law, I think, is pretty obvious from what we've said, and I'm not going to talk about the development of the common law defense, because Carol has already touched on that. And I've already mentioned that judges and the legislature can also change the law. So I think for purposes of our discussion today, the important thing is how the Constitution impacts private law relationships. Because I think when the Bill of Rights was designed, I think the intention was to enforce rights against the state. So your vertical application of the Bill of Rights. And to some extent, the horizontal application. But the horizontal application of the Bill of Rights, enforcing my rights against this next individual, a private individual, is something that we didn't think through. In as far as the parent and child relationship is concerned, because parents not only have a right to raise their children, they also have an obligation to discipline them. But now we're seeing children enforcing their individual rights against their parents. So that is quite problematic, and it's not an easy pill to swallow. So I think we need to talk about that. So in some democracies, South Africa included, people have a problem with being told what to do by the courts, by the state. You cannot tell me how to raise my child. You cannot tell me what to do in my house. But the courts, in as much as the courts are mandated to develop the common law, the courts are mandated to ensure that everybody meets their constitutional obligations. They do not take the fact that they have to tell people how to raise their children in the home, how to get into the private sphere. They don't take it lightly. It's not something that they enjoy doing, but they must do it because they're under a constitutional obligation. So in 2016, if you see in red there, Justice van der Westhuizen, how far does the Constitution and its interpretation and enforcement by courts reach into our private and social lives? Is there somewhere in our churches, temples, mosques, and synagogues, or for that matter, our kitchens and bedrooms, a constitution-free zone? And I think the abolition of corporal punishment essentially answers that question, to say there is no constitution-free zone. Right. So we're on the same page there. So the problem is that there's an exaggerated dichotomy, a conflict between parental rights and children's rights. The two are not mutually exclusive. You can have both of them, but I think the reason we have such a big problem is that we always view children's rights through our own interests as parents, as caregivers, as adults. And we're having difficulty in shifting that mindset to view the child as an individual rights holder. So what do we need to do? It's a problem. So I think for our purposes, the value of the Constitutional Court judgment is essentially it's strong-arming us to face a reality that we have to deal with in South Africa, recognizing children's individual rights. So what do we need to do? The Constitutional Court judgment essentially says you cannot raise that defense anymore, so you cannot physically punish your children as a way to discipline them. So if we have a provision in the Third Amendment, we can clarify certain concerns that have come up since we got the Constitutional Court judgment in September 2019. So one of those, or some of those concerns are around the criminalization of parents, that you're now, if I smack my child, I'm going to be criminalized, I'm going to be arrested. The effect of this is that, you know, they're trying to separate or destroy families. That's not what we want. So if we have a provision in the Children's Act, we can clearly state that, first of all, the defense, the removal of the defense and the development of the common law is not to criminalize parents, but is to encourage positive discipline. The second thing is we need to also clarify safety nets that are available to parents in the Children's Act. How do we do that? The first one is that if you look in terms of Section 110, the first response is not a criminal justice response. So once a parent is reported, we're not going to rush to the police officer to the police station and report. A social worker has to do an assessment, and they make a recommendation. So we need to clarify that in law, and the sort of steps that now need to be to take place between that reporting and the follow-up action. So also in the Children's Act, by having a provision in the Children's Act, we're essentially highlighting that the criminalization of parents is not in the best interest of children. So if it's a light smack and if, you know, a parent can be diverted to prevention and early intervention, they can still stay at home, they can still be with their child. But if there's reasonable concern, if there's justification to believe that it's actually abuse, then the parent should be arrested, because abuse is abuse is abuse. Like, we've heard the evidence that most of the child homicides in South Africa are corporal punishment gone wrong. So we need to stop the buck early. So the other safety net that we have is a prosecutorial discretion. So if the matter gets reported to the NPA, the prosecutor can decide whether or not to go through with the prosecution. So one of the things that we want to push for there, and it's a suggestion for us to think, is to have directives to the NPA to say, when a prosecutor comes with a case where a parent is accused of using corporal punishment or punitive violence, can we divert them to certain programs? But what those programs are and what that diversion looks like is a discussion that we need to have, either in this room, or when we go back to our various workplaces. So, and the last thing is that the law does not concern itself with trivialities, the de minimis non curat lex. So not all reported cases will be prosecuted. So I think this needs to come out. If we have a provision talking to the issue of corporal punishment in the Children's Act, we'll be able to clarify these issues and also to make all the parents know what exactly happens should they use corporal punishment in the home. I don't know, can you see that? So so in the sector, there are mixed views. There are people who are of the view that, there are some colleagues who are of the view that we need to have a clear abolition, explicit ban that says that corporal punishment will be abolished in the home. Now, there are others who are of the view that we already have the Constitutional Court judgment. So we don't need to have something that clearly states it that way, because when it gets to Parliament, parliamentarians are going to, you know, fight over it and then remove the provision, because this happened again previously in 2002. So what we're proposing is, or what I'm proposing and what I'm suggesting and putting before you, is to have a provision that talks about, if you look at 12.1a there, the highlighted sections. When disciplining the child, you must guide them while respecting, promoting, and protecting to the fullest extent possible the child's constitutional rights. Right? Section 2, subsection 2 there, I removed the removal of the common law defense, because we already have the Concord judgment. So how can we do that? Again, in legislation, so again, it's debatable whether or not we need to have an explicit provision like that to say the common law is removed from our law. But if we put it that way, there might be pushback in Parliament, with people not understanding exactly what that means. So I'd rather we have a softer approach where we look at, you know, guiding, disciplining our children, and not talk so much about you know, the reasonable chastisement defense, because it's already in our law. It's already there. And so because we've removed that, we need to talk about what are we replacing that which we have removed. So we're replacing it with now, if you look at subsection 3, referrals to prevention and early intervention programs in terms of section 144 of the Children's Act. Then we talk about what the mandate or what obligations the Department of Social Development has. Education and awareness raising programs. Programs promoting positive discipline. And then subsection 5, when all else fails, we need to refer to, there's a section, section 110 has got provisions on reporting child abuse. So the other thing that we also need to make very clear is the criminal justice system is the absolute last resort. So criminalizing our parents is the very last resort, and we need to put that in the Children's Act. And so this provision, the strengths, or one of the reasons why I like this provision, is that it's not linked to any offense. So it essentially achieves what we want, to make it clear to parents that using corporal punishment or using punitive violence is no longer acceptable. And if you violate that, what will happen to you as a parent? And what are the obligations of the department? And I'm going to leave you with Justice Albie Sachs, what one of the things that he said. It's one of our favorite quotes at the Center for Child Law, where he said that every child has his or her own dignity, and if a child is to be constitutionally imagined as an individual with distinct personality and not merely as a miniature adult waiting to reach full size. So I think that is very important. I think Carol mentioned it, that, you know, we tend to look at children as if we own them, but they're their own beings with their own dignity. And I think we need to embrace that based on Justice Albie Sachs' quote above. The end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Isabel. At this point, I'm going to ask Divya Naidu from Save the Children South Africa to give us more feedback on what can be done in order to deal with the quality of life of our children. Divya, over to you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, we've heard all the gloom and doom of what's going on, but there is still hope. But before we get into that, let me just ask you a few questions, just two actually. And I want to look at whether it's true or false. It's a little quiz. Children usually tell somebody about their abuse. True or false? I hear some true, and I hear some false. False. Most children do not tell anybody. We've heard the stats. Only 1 in 9 children are actually reporting when abuse occurs. And it's often because they've been silenced by threats or just fear, or they just do not have the voice themselves to explain what exactly has happened to them. Question two. Abused children hate their parents and want to get away from them. True or false? False. There's consensus on this. Okay. Most children who have experienced abuse by their parents still have very strong attachments and love for them. And all of us that have worked in that sector know that, and you see that children do still care about their parents. They just want the violence to end. So what can we do for these children? So what is positive discipline? Now let's start by just talking a little bit about the difference between corporal punishment and positive discipline. So we understand corporal punishment focuses on what a child has done wrong, while positive discipline assumes that children want to learn and just need to be guided in terms of what they should do. Corporal punishment is based on the principle that you have to make children suffer. They have to feel some kind of pain in order for them to learn. Whereas positive discipline is based on the principle that children learn through cooperation. And this is very critical when we think about how we guide children and help them as they grow up. And it's a key thing when parents talk about that children will not learn if they do not get punished. And yet it has been proven otherwise, that children do actually learn when they do not feel physical pain. Research has shown that corporal punishment, and Carol spoke about that in the Gershoff study, there was actually only one positive outcome to corporal punishment: immediate compliance. Very short-term immediate compliance. So think about a scenario. You tell the child, don't do that. You hit them, and they shut up for the moment. And then what happens 2 minutes later? They're back. So why aren't we learning that it doesn't actually work? And so corporal punishment results in immediate compliance, but no self-discipline and repeated behavior. Whereas positive discipline, on the other hand, results in understanding, self-discipline, and a change in behavior. And isn't that what we want? We want children to behave in a way, especially when we're not present. Not just to feel that they need to be policed all the time. And we see that often in adult behavior. When adults, just when there's a police around, you'll drive properly. And when there's no police there, then okay, let me go over that barrier line, let me do all those things. It's because of the lack of self-discipline. You don't just do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. And that's what self-discipline is about. And that's where it starts with children, when we teach them how to have internal mechanisms to do right and wrong. Corporal punishment establishes the link between love and violence, whereas positive discipline establishes the link between love and respect. Now, research was done in the Eastern Cape some years ago where young girls were saying that they believed that their boyfriend did not actually care about them if they didn't hit them. And those young girls obviously grew up in families where they're seeing the father hitting the mother, they've got hit by them. And it's that loving smack we cared for. That's what love means. It means we show somebody by our possessiveness, by the violence we use, that that equals love. Whereas it actually focuses on teaching children to understand the link between love and respect. And respect is not something we demand. Respect is something we earn. Respect is something we earn by actually showing it to children. So positive discipline is not a behavior management method. So behavior management focuses on obedience, teaching children to be obedient and to follow everything we as adults are saying. Whereas positive discipline focuses on our understanding of children. You see, corporal punishment is not about how children behave and what they do. Children will be children. They can be such angels when they're sleeping, and as some people say, they can be monsters when they're awake. But we still love them anyway. They're still children, and they're learning and they're growing. Corporal punishment is about us as adults and how we respond to children's behavior and how we teach them. And usually we don't understand why they're doing something. So when children want to just play and jump about and we think they're making too much noise, we think their behavior is bad. They have the right to play. It is in the UN Convention. We just don't understand that children are being children and they're playing, and therefore we use corporal punishment as the way. So positive discipline helps us understand that children have a need to play. And when we understand that, we don't see the behavior as being bad. We understand that, and we can work and we change our own attitude towards how we respond to that behavior. Positive discipline, and this is the part that parents are often very concerned about. Positive discipline is not about punishment other than hitting and shouting. So, for instance, it's not acceptable to say to the child, okay, go and stand in the corner. If you look in the picture there, okay, writing. You know, the common things in schools is go and write, I will not do this here. And there was a really nice story that I just have to share. It was a case where in court this judge had somebody there who was speeding, and she asked the person at the end of it, oh, what is your profession? And she said, I'm a teacher. And she said, okay. And the judge said, okay, this is wonderful. I waited for years. Now I want you to go and sit in the corner and write down 500 times, I will not speed. You know, just as an aside, everybody's looking too serious in here. But it's not about, other sorts of things without hitting or shouting at children. Corporal punishment is certainly not about letting children do whatever they want to do. It's critical for us to understand, and this is where parents' fear is. So are you saying that I should just leave them to do what they want to? No, you still have rules. But work around how you develop the rules. Work with children to decide on what those rules should be and what the consequences are when those rules get violated. And when children are part of processes of engaging in deciding on what's right and wrong in their lives, they're learning how to make decisions, but at the same time, they own those decisions. And they have better understanding as well for what needs to be done, how they will behave, and what they need to do as they go forward. And this is the fear of most parents. What do I do? How do I raise my child without any rules? And the key thing is, no, it's not about not having any rules. Corporal punishment is, positive discipline is not about quick fix solutions. Now, if you think of the situation, you know, a child does something wrong, you just go in and you hit them. Quick answer, you've sorted it out. They're silent for a few moments. They're quiet about it. But for how long, as I said, they go back. It's not the solution. Now, when a child does something wrong, to sit down and to have a conversation with them about what they've done and what the risks that should be and how that's going to affect them, that takes time. And that is the difficult part for parents, where people are struggling with, I am so rushed, and now you want me to sit down and to talk to them about what they've done right and wrong. After the Concord judgment, there was a whole lot of WhatsApp messages going around and pictures and things like that about people, take your child, leave them at the Constitutional Court, a child sitting with the floor with all the tiles broken and saying, now, you know, should I just stay quiet and sit and talk to them? All kinds of crazy things. But it's, how hard is it for us to just talk to our children? Isn't that the joy about being parents? And we're not saying that the conversations have to be in-depth. So your little six-month-old child goes in to stick the finger into the plug point, block that plug point, cover it, because you can't have a conversation with the child of that age about the dangers of electricity. But you can just cover it. But as they're older, you can engage children in discussions around what is right and wrong. And so what happens? So what happens in that process? Let's look at two scenarios. Parents, father hits mother. Both parent hit their child. The child goes to school. The child then, the teacher, hits the child. And what goes on in that child's mind? They're bigger than me. So it's okay for somebody bigger to hit someone smaller. They don't like what I do. So it's okay when somebody bigger doesn't like what somebody does, and therefore you can hit them. And this child goes out onto the playground, and they see this little guy there. I don't like what he's doing. And he goes and gives him a kick. And what do we call them? Bullies. So where's this child learned this behavior from? From us adults. And that's the key thing that parents are not getting, that we as adults seem to be missing the point, is that children are learning violence from our behavior. There's a lovely saying that goes, don't worry that children don't listen to what you tell them to do, because they're busy watching what you're doing. Because children watch how we behave, and we have to be those good role models that teach them and guide them, not by just telling, but by how we respond to a situation. So when we respond to a situation, a crisis, by using violence, that's the message they learn. But on the other hand, when we sit down and take the time to talk to children when they're young and from the time they're little about right and wrong, we're teaching them a couple of good lessons, and we're actually practicing positive parenting without even realizing it. What we're teaching children is we're teaching children communication skills. Research has found that parents who raise children by using positive discipline, the word count of children increases more. And why? Because when you're doing them, how many times I told you, don't do this, shut up, shut up. What are they learning? Two words, shut up. But when you're having a conversation, they're learning new words. And so their word count increases in that process. They're learning negotiation skills, because they're saying, but I want this. And you're listening to what they're saying, and you're saying, but this is the risks. They're learning negotiation skills in that process. But they're also learning intrinsically how to make informed decisions about right and wrong. And that is the critical thing that we need to make sure. So as children grow up older, when they have difficult decisions to make, so for example, that young girl whose boyfriend is insisting, if you don't sleep with me, then our relationship is over. Who should that child turn to for guidance? Should she go to her teenage friend who's as confused and saying, what, he's really cute, you don't want to let him go? Or should she go to an adult who'd be able to guide her to make that right decision? We as adults want children to come to us. But will she come to us as a parent if all we say is, how many times I've told you not to do this, or I told you not? Children therefore won't turn to us. So positive discipline is not a once-off overnight event. It's a lifetime process. It's a journey between parent and child that continues, and it evolves with the issues. But when we start it correctly and we start with children when they're young and engage them and talk to them about the things that matter, in the long term, they always turn to us. And then when we're not around, they look within and they're able to make those right choices because we've taught them through practice over practice over practice what is important and how to make those right decisions. And it's quite interesting. I love to use this quote by Madiba, and I actually saw it on the program as well, which reaffirmed it. There can be no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way in which it treats its children. And so what kind of society do we want to be seen as? What kind of soul do we want to be as a democracy? Do we want to continue to be seen as one of the most violent countries in the world? Or do we want to be seen as a country that really values our children? And the first international treaty that was signed by South Africa when President Mandela became president and in 1995 was the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Why? Because what was the buzzword then? Children first. It was because he placed children so high on the agenda that he gave 50% or something of his salary towards setting up the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. Because children are that critical and that important. And so what is our investment? What do we want to invest? And we've heard from Shanaz earlier on about this intergenerational cycle and what it does for children. I just want to say, so what difference does positive parenting programming make? And I just want to share with you one case story. There was a young girl who grew up in a family who rejected her because her father had rejected her, and she lived with her mother and her mother's family, and she was treated very badly. And as a child, she hurt a lot all the time. And when she grew up, she had a child of her own, a little son. And she treated him very much the way she was raised, by disregarding him, always hitting him and shouting at him and treating him very badly. And the child would often spend a lot of time out of the home during the course of the day. And when he comes back late, she would hit him for being home late. And then along the way, she got invited to attend one of the Save the Children parenting programs. And as she went through this 8-week program with us, week by week, she started to realize for herself what she was doing to her child was exactly what had happened to her. And she remembered the hurt she felt as a mother and realized she was causing the same pain and suffering with her child. And so she started to practice the lessons she had learned in each session. And she saw a change in her own behavior first, in what she did. And that's what parenting did. She changed her own attitude and behavior towards her child. And her relationship with her child changed for the better. In fact, she even said to the facilitator, "I enjoy being a mother," because she felt so good about being a mother as she went in there. The child's behavior changed. He started spending more time at home, because he actually enjoyed being with his mother and spending time with her. So she realized then his staying out was because of what she was doing. He, in fact, even started to bring his friends home to spend more time because they all were hearing all these wonderful things his mother is doing. And that's the key lesson for us, is let's love our children. Let them be. Enjoy this time. They only have 18 years of being children. Let's treasure it. So as they grow up and they become older, we relive those moments of joy and excitement with them in our whole life again. And there's a quote up there by our founder of Save the Children, Eglantine Jebb. And I want to read one part of it. She said, you know, people often say that child suffering has happened and it always will. It's impossible only if we make it so. It's impossible if we refuse to attempt it. And I'm calling on all of us to attempt to do something about it. Thank you.
I'd like us to give a big hand for the four presenters that have shared with us.
please sign up for our newsletter. News of our events and our podcasts can be accessed via our website at cplo.org.za.